It is wonderful to talk about marriage, the most basic of God's institutions. Marriage is the foundation for society. Marriage is the means by which God saw fit to procreate the world. Marriage is a high and noble kind of act that is engaged in by people who are looking for the kind of happiness that only marriage can provide. And so it's a delight to talk about it. We've talked about several different things that have to do with marriage. I want to introduce what I'm going to talk about this morning by looking at a passage in 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. I'm just going to read a couple of verses here, three. In verse 3, the Apostle Paul, by the prompting of the Holy Spirit, said, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations, and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." Every time Ed and I work together, it just always happens that some kind of theme sort of projects itself out of our sermons. And if there is a theme that has come out of this particular series, it seems to me that is this theme of our separation from the world. And we have seen that in every part of what we've talked about. We've seen it in all of Ed's lessons concerning the movement that we call the Restoration. And we have seen it in the marriage things, because the marriage things are not governed by man and by society, but by God. And so this morning I'm going to continue that thought. And I want to talk with you about culture and its effect on marriage. We're all trying to go somewhere. The student is trying to graduate. The workman works for advancement as well as salary. The professor seeks to turn out more and new and better professors. The boss wants productivity. The poor want wealth. The wealthy want health. We're all headed somewhere. And culture is the path on which most of this journey takes place. Amy Caesar, the black writer at the turn of the century, said of culture, "Culture is everything. Culture is the way we dress, the way we carry our heads, the way we walk, the way we tie our ties. It's not only the fact of writing books or building houses." And she is well within the mark. Culture is more than just art or architecture or music, more than literature. Culture is how we do what we do on a daily basis. If we allow it, and most people do, I might add, it is perhaps the singular most influential force in our lives, culture is. And so it certainly has had an effect, and mostly an adverse one, on marriage and the home in our society. I just want to talk with you a little bit about that. And in order to do that, I want to define some words for you. And they may sound a bit complex when we start, but if you'll stay with me, we'll come to terms on these matters. And you'll be able to see where I'm going rather rapidly. What about culture? Just exactly what is it, and where does it come from, and how does it get where it's going? To understand the terms, let's just define it, first of all. Here's a digestion that I've made from about four different dictionaries. And here's what I came up with. Culture is the totality of socially transmitted behavioral patterns, arts, beliefs, institutions, and all other products of human work and thought characteristic of a community or a population. Now that sounds very complex. I want you to see two words in there. Socially transmitted. Hear it again. It is the totality of socially transmitted patterns, behavioral patterns. That is, it is intended to be received. It is transmitted. Culture transmits something. Culture includes such ideas as cultivation, breeding, taste. All are defined by the community. And it seems to me that culture has to do with acceptance and with conformity and with participation. Culture is the development or cultivating. Notice the word, if you will, please, because culture and cultivation come from the same place. Culture, then, is the development or cultivating of the human mind, of its faculties, its manners, its tastes, and its beliefs, according to what is considered to be acceptable by the community. Now, keep that just kind of in your mind, and let me define for you society. There's a difference between society and culture, and both figure into this thing that we're going to talk about this morning. Society, I've reduced this to this definition, the totality of social relationships among human beings, the institutions and culture of a distinct self-perpetuating group. The term society, incidentally, is from the Latin word societas, and that means fellowship. That'll give you a pretty good idea of what you have in society. We're all part of society, like it or not, because society is actually, in the ultimate reality, the people. Society is mutual existence in a community, and it is the society, it is the people, it is the community that determines the cultural pursuit. It approves innovations or it restricts changes by social pressure. Social pressure is a very strong kind of pressure. Culture, in a very real sense, is what society then has cultivated, if we can get that fixed in our minds. And so what we have is, in a kind of simple conclusion, society is the people together, and culture is what they approve together. Let me say that again. Society is the people viewed together, and culture is what they approve together. Now let me get some passages involved. In Romans chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2, the Apostle Paul said, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world. This world here, the warning is against the encroachments of society, its allurements and its temptations. It is a warning against conformity to the culture of your age. To conform is to be in compliance with the thing, and conformity into the world brings you into agreement with the world. And so he says, don't do that. You're distinctive from the world. You must remain distinctive. That means that you must show yourself to be different than what the world is. In 1 John chapter 2 and verses 15 through 17, John, through the Holy Spirit, said, love not the world. And then listen. Now, the world is the society that you live in. Now listen to the culture. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eye and the vainglory of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away and the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. Now that's the distinction that you have to make between you and the world, because what he's saying to you is that the worldly things are not worth considering when they're laid alongside the otherworldly things. Because the otherworldly things have eternal ramifications while the worldly things pass away. Way here. So he's talking about culture and society in James chapter 4 and verse 4. James says, ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that friendship with the world. Now when you view the world, what you're viewing is what the world does, what the world is. It is society and culture together. The world, he says, friendship with the world is enmity with God. Wherefore, whoever would be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. You can't be both. That's what he's saying. Here is a stern warning, then, against giving yourself in just without any fact to culture. The danger in such an enterprise is couched in very graphic terms. He calls it adultery. If you try to hold on to the world with one hand and hold on to God with the other, he said that's adultery. That's a serious kind of observation. So to be friends with the world is to do what the world does. What a serious description. To be the enemy of God. And so in Romans chapter 5, or chapter 8 and verse 5, he says, for those that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit for the things of the Spirit, for to be carnally minded is death. But to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Being after the flesh is equal to giving heed to the seductions of the flesh, an act that culture not only approves but recommends. And you should not be involved in that. Carnality separates you from God and couples you with the world. In order to have its approval, you must surrender the Word of God to the Word of the world, to culture, to what's around you. Okay, now, with those things in mind, let's see what society has done just generally for a few minutes. Here are some areas where society just asks for conformity, where it invites you to be a part of it. In education, for instance, education, particularly higher education, almost demands certain concessions that will admit naturalism and Darwinism and those kinds of things, and that will enter into all sorts of speculations about how the world came into effect and how it just evolved. These demands are based on affirmations, incidentally, that religion, which once was admittedly a useful thing and served a useful purpose, has outlived its usefulness. That's the idea of postmodernism, one of the ideas. And it says that because of our present superior knowledge and technology, that religion has become antiquated. It is outmoded. It is no longer needed. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the basis of the God is dead theory that was advanced early in this century by some of the philosophers. I have told you, I have been told, here's a quote from Paul Johnson in his book, Reason in the Balance. He says, I have been told by many modernists that to assert the reality of God as creator is dogmatic and arrogant, since it is to imply that I have a knowledge that is unavailable to scientific naturalists. It's amazing, then, and how education has evolved into a declaration that there is no God. That God didn't create anything because there isn't any God. In fact, what higher education would have you believe is that man invented God. God didn't invent man. Man invented God. And when it was useful, he just throws it. When it's no longer useful, he just throws him away. The arts have been really adverse in their effect on us. Music, literature, art, theater are the most influential. The arts are the reflectors as well as the motivators of what we are. If you look at the arts, you can tell what culture is today. If you look at the arts, you can tell how culture is motivating society today. Both those things are there. They're sanctioned by society. Homosexuality, free sex, nudity, pornography are products of our culture. They are sanctioned for participation by any who see the need for them. And that's based exactly on what Dr. Harold talked about last night, and that is the idea of subjectivism. Pornography is now a $4 billion a year business, much of which is protected by society's interpretation of the right of free speech. Now, that's what culture is doing. That's its law, you see. What I choose to call the my rights mentality has promoted sex and sexual innuendo as a major theme in television, in movies, and in novels. The movies, the TV shows, and the novels based on high moral themes are just out the window. They no longer exist. It is my right to see and hear what I want to see and hear, society says. It's now estimated that after graduation, most students will have committed sex, most of them with multiple partners. I suggest to you, too, that one of the heinous things that's being promoted today, and that was promoted by some of our hierarchical people, is that oral sex is not considered to be sex. And our young people are using that as a reason for engaging in sexual promiscuity. Hollywood has made an all-out attack on religion, on its claims and institutions, its requirements, and its moral suggestions. For instance, the best picture of that is how Hollywood views a clergyman. It doesn't make any difference what kind. He's either an Elmer Gantry type guy or a Jim Baker type fella who's bilking the people out of money, or he's some absolute total nincompoop, some imbecilic sort of fella who couldn't do anything but preach. And that may be right. I don't know. I had a friend tell me a while back, I say a friend, it was an acquaintance, he told me he couldn't find a job, and he said, you know, if I can't find a job before long, he said, I'm not too good to preach. And that's how some people feel about it. That's how society feels about it. Rock music is staggeringly obscene, so much so that I couldn't read the lyrics to it to my wife in a closed bedroom, much less read some of the lyrics to you. Violence is rampant on television. The Reader's Digest, in an article that I saw recently, said by the time a child reaches 18 years old, he has witnessed 18,000 murders on television. Is it any wonder that the Columbine massacre took place? Is it any wonder that people are going around shooting other people? They're used to doing that in the games that they play and the various things that they do. And I will not spend your time on subjectivism, because Brother Harold has done that better than I could. But I want to suggest to you that when we go through these things, like the arts, what bothers me is that Christians are allowing the encroachments of these things to come in amongst them. For instance, now here's you an oxymoron. Here is you a contradiction in terms. Christian rock. All that is the matter of society pervading religion. And religion has accepted it. Rather than holding up the banner of Christ, what religion has done is let it come in. We'll accept what we can accept. And they don't understand that things don't stand still. As I said the other day, that which is evil will invariably become more evil. And that which is good will inevitably become better. But the fact is, when you let something in like Christian rock, it's just a little ways from just throwing the whole thing down the drain. Subjectivism. Subjectivism issues in a lot of different ways. Subjectivism is the idea that a person has the right to do whatever he wants to. It's nobody can tell me what to do. That's subjectivism. It's one of the my rights mentality, I call it. Truth is whatever a person determines that it is. And it doesn't trample on the rights of, if it doesn't trample on the rights of others, then it's okay to do it. The practical result of that is Joseph Fletcher's situation ethics. That's all it is. And the work, that work says that whatever the situation demands is the truth on that matter. And even if that's a lie, you can do what you need to do. Truth becomes purely subjective, and there's no such thing as objective truth. Truth that never changes. And Brother Harold did a masterful job of setting that for us last night. Judge Robert Bork, in his book Slouching Towards Gomorrah, suggests that there are a couple of things involved in that subjective kind of usage that have really become big in this age. One of them he calls radical individualism. Radical individualism. That's the my rights mentality. That's all it is. It just says I'm the authority. I'm the one who makes the rules. I make the rules, and if I don't like how things are going, all I do is change the rules internally and everything's okay. That's radical individualism, the inordinate elevation of the individual and his rights in society. Nobody can tell me what to do is common in this day and age. And then he cites radical egalitarianism. That's a big word that says everybody wants to be the same. There isn't any difference in anybody. The theory that everyone is equal to everyone else in everything. Sexual equality is a major assertion here, that there's no difference between the sexes. I would talk, if I had time, about values clarification, which was introduced in England in 1976 in a work called Values and Teaching, which sought to cause students to come to terms with their own moral values from personal beliefs to help them confront difficult morals problems when they came in contact with them. And all it is subjectivism. It's just gone to seed. Sex education has introduced ambiguous moral standards by implication into the lives of our young people. The idea of schools promoting safe sex implicates that sex is all right so long as it's safe sex. And so there are just all kinds of little subtle innuendos, little subtle entrances, little subtle encroachments that come from society. How does the church adapt that? How does religion adapt that? Well, I'll tell you how to adapt subjectivism. It's been around for a long, long time, and it says it doesn't make any difference what you believe, just as long as you're honest and sincere. You ever hear that? That's not a thing in this world, but just subjectivism. Well, I've saved this one for last because I believe it to be the most significant of all of the intrusions that the devil has concocted. Feminism. I verily believe that the most ingeniously concocted and carefully executed plan that the devil has devised in recent years, perhaps in all time, since the Garden of Eden, is feminism. What it does is blur the roles of male and female. Bork calls the problem radical feminism and says, and I quote, "Radical feminism is the most destructive and fanatical movement to come down to us from the 60s. Now, I know that we sometimes think we know about these things. I want to read you two or three things that I found that just show you what feminism really is. Not the thing that you see on the television, like popular feminism, where they're advancing the cause of the women. Nobody is opposed to women's rights. But I want to read you a couple of things. Here is the stated purpose of feminism. Listen to this statement from feminists Daphne Patai and Noreta Katie about the goal of feminism in the universities. Feminism is not merely about equal rights for women. Feminism aspires to be much more than this. It bids to be a totalizing scheme resting on a grand theory, one that is all-inclusive as Marxism, as assured of its ability to unmask hidden meanings as Freudian psychology, and as fervent in its condemnation of apostates as is evangelical fundamentalism. Feminist theory provides a doctrine of original sins. The world's evil originated in male supremacy." Now look at your Bible and read what I called God's law of order early on, and then compare that to it. Let me give you another quickly. Here's the goal of radical feminism. Professor Christina Hoff Summers wrote in her book, Who Stole Feminism, what she felt should appear in the bulletins of the feminist-minded school in America. Now, this is what she proposes that should be in the college bulletin. "We will help your daughter discover the extent to which she has been in complicity with the patriarchy. We will encourage her to reconstruct herself through dialogue with us. She may become enraged and chronically offended. She will likely reject the religious and moral codes you have raised her with. She may well distance herself from family and friends. She may change her appearance, even her sexual orientation. She may end up hating you, the father, and pitying her, the mother. After she has completed her re-education with us, you will certainly be out tens of thousands of dollars and very possibly be out one daughter as well." You think that's not a serious consideration? I made a speech for the Texas Association of Women in Broadcasting one time. And the lady who was the other keynote speaker with me was a lady who was the advertising director for one of the major cosmetics firms. And she spoke right before I did. And she got up and made the observation about God that she created woman. I said that like she said it. She called God she. Now, I likely will never be invited back to speak for the Texas Women's Association of Broadcasters. But there's one cigarette-sucking, wrinkled old woman that won't be referring to God as a she, as if that was some kind of special thing, without looking over her shoulder again. Bork says of women deliberately becoming housewives, "Perhaps the most vicious aspect of radical feminism is that it necessarily criticizes and demeans women who choose to work primarily as mothers and homemakers. They are made to feel guilty and told that they're essentially worthless." Margie Gallagher, in an article in the National Review, got it right. She said, "Liberal feminism triumphed by telling a lie about nearly all women and men. The work women do in families may not perhaps seem great compared to inventing a new morality or discovering the cure to cancer, but it compares quite favorably in value, meaning, and social productiveness with being the vice president of a public affairs for General Motors or, say, a partner in an advertising firm, and it is necessary that we start saying so. She further concludes, in the end, our girls are going to have to fight their girls. Bork concludes by saying, true, but after all that, some males in the academic world, in the military, and in the Congress are going to have to summon the courage to begin to repair the damage that feminism has done. And notice again, hear me carefully, how religion, unable to muster the courage to fight for biblical principles regarding the roles of males and females, has absorbed the movement by announcing with some pride and some degree of broad-mindedness a thing called religious feminism. And if you think we're not feeling that in churches of Christ, read some of the things that are being stated about women in the churches. Well, culture's attack then is on the fundamentals of the marriage relationship. God made man in His own image. He created male and female. So God created man in His own image. In the image of God created He them. Male and female created He them. Naturalism is an attempt to explain man's existence apart from creation. If man is merely a biological phenomenon, morality is actually whatever he decides it is. And if a man is actually the product of evolution, then in reality God did not create man, but man created God. Marriage then becomes a convenient way of creating and maintaining society. It has no moral significance at all. Under such a status, divorce is as much a part of culture as is marriage. God made them marriage partners. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. In today's society, there is no stigma attached to breaking the marriage bond. It's merely a convenient agreement to begin with, and when that agreement becomes a disagreement, then there's no longer any need to stay together. Is it any wonder that the divorce rate is now up to 50%? A man is to cleave to his own wife. He's to make her his own companion. That fundamental principle has not been just eroded, but completely ignored in today's world. Why buy a cow when you can get milk through the fence? That quote is often attributed to Elvis Presley, and it describes accurately the attitude of many toward free sex. There is no shame. People get sex whenever and wherever they want it, regardless of the fact that they're married. I saw a recent magazine article where a supermodel discussed her four former marriages. And the title of the article, "This Time I Got It Right." Is that sick or what? What is right anyway? Does it not matter that the second was wrong and the third and the fourth? How can the fifth be right? Marriage is an institution of our God, and it needs to be viewed as such. God made marriage for man's procreation. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it." Marriage is the legitimate means for producing offspring. It provides both the time and place for reproduction. Procreation outside this legitimate relationship brings only sadness and heartache. And what does man do to it? Abortion. Save the whales, kill the babies. There's something wrong with that. Something wrong with that. Discussing the matter of abortion, Dr. Clifford E. Bahiman, his book Abortion and the Meaning of Personhood, concludes the section in the basic issue by saying this, and he's okay with abortion, but listen to what he says. If the zygote embryo fetus is not a living being, no one should have any serious problems with abortion. If it is a living human being, then by all means, every man should do everything within his power to stop the senseless and immoral manslaughter. And the United States Supreme Court, notwithstanding, what is legal is not necessarily moral. And that's the way that works. And the final reality, culture does not define what is moral. God defines what is moral. God made sex for marriage and only marriage. Along comes man, does what he wants to with it. Know ye not that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them the members of a harlot? God forbid. What? Know ye not that he which is joined to an harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh. But he that is joined to the Lord is one spirit. Flee fornication. Every man that does that without the body commits fornication against the body. Today's society sees no sin in premarital or extramarital sex. 72% of high school seniors have had sexual intercourse. According to the Center for Disease Control report from 1994, 19% have had four or more partners. And listen to this quote. I feel fulfilled in life. Because I played a major role in the sexual revolution of our time. As a result of my work and my example, I have helped people become more comfortable with sexual freedom and in that way contributed to the enrichment of life. I tell you, Hugh Hefner better enjoy that while he can, because it's going to be hot where he's going to live. Such cultural icons as movies, television, and internet have sold the American people, particularly young people, on the idea that sex is allowable under any circumstances so long as it's done consensually. I could go on and on. I realize that that's more complex than maybe what you wanted to hear, but we need to hear that. Get the tape and listen to what it says, or get the CD and listen to what it says, because culture has invaded us, people, about these things. And society is selling us a bill of goods. And they're selling our young people in churches about this. We're letting down our guard on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. We're letting down our guard and we're accepting things that God does not accept. We must not do that. We must understand that we are separate. That we are peculiar people. That the kingdom that we're a part of is not of this world. And that our king is not of this world. And we need to understand that we're going someplace. We're headed someplace. I am Christian and I walk with the king. Thank you very kindly.